Thank you for joining us on Feed the Crew. If you haven't already, please subscribe and follow us on Facebook or Instagram. If you have any feedback, if you'd like to be a guest or suggest a topic, go to our website, feedthecrewpodcast.com. If you love the show and want to support us, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/feedthecrew. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Feed the Crew. Today, we're bringing you Kirsten Johnson. She is a TD and project manager here in the Houston area. So tell us, before we begin, a little bit about yourself.
The little bit of formal education that I have, I had a two-year degree from a video technical college in Dallas back in the 80s. And after that, I searched around and searched around to try and find a job. And I wound up becoming a receptionist at an AV rental house in Houston in 1991. And then from there, I just was hanging out in the warehouse and I saw the guys playing with projectors and computers and editing systems and stuff like that. And so I just started hanging out with them and, you know, learning to do projection and other things. And eventually, and them letting me screw around with some of the gear and setting stuff up in front of clients. That was fun. And eventually moved to my first production company in Dallas in 95-ish, I think, Richard Kidd. And then from there, just kept learning and progressing and doing all kinds of stuff. But everything I've learned, quite frankly, is stuff I've learned on show sites, either from my own mistakes, my own best guesses, or watching other people mess up and figuring out how I could have done it better.
Right.
You know.
That's very similar to my education.
Right.
So what I want to talk with you about today are challenges that we face in the industry. It has a lot to do with when we started and women in the industry.
I would say from the very get-go, I mean, and even today, even though it's not as prevalent, there has always been a lot of misogyny in the industry. And especially starting here in Houston, you know, the major production companies in town, you know, one's a rock and roll house, you know? So if you weren't out on tour, which girls weren't allowed to go out on tour in the 90s, really. And if you did, everybody thought you were sleeping with everybody on the crew, that you somehow weren't qualified. You couldn't lift anything. You couldn't know anything. You couldn't think about anything past, you know, go get me a cup of coffee, sweetheart, kind of tasks. And that, you know, that was always a battle. You know, proving myself and sometimes doing it poorly and then other times doing it really well. And as I did that, got more and more respect from the folks here in town. And when I started working outside the city and working with other production companies, those soft skills that I learned from working with guys here, working with, you know, the good old boys, that served me well going forward. Fortunately, it's not the ways that I was treated or have been treated in the industry early on in my career up until about the 2010s, 2012-ish. A lot of those problems that I've had have gone away. Thank you, Me Too. But, I still encounter it every now and then.
Yeah.
Here and there. Just because, you know, and usually it's from the youngsters now. It used to be from the old guys. Ooh. Now it's from the kids.
No way.
Yeah. My last experience with a younger technician was that, you know, he didn't get that I had institutional knowledge about a system that we were working on. And he was very, very adamant that we do things a certain way. And he couldn't let me back up. And, you know, because there was a new setup, a new wrinkle to it that I hadn't experienced yet. And he'd been working with it for 2 days. I was also working with the local truck crew. And me and the local truck crew, it was a broadcast system. Okay. We've known each other for years, have worked together for years. And they throw epithets at, like, you know, like they say the word flop like it's a comma. You know, they use it all the time. And I answered, I was just as salty right back at them. And that kid got so offended that I was, you know, bossing right back at them the same way. And that whole crew was male, and he didn't have a problem with them cussing. He had a problem with the female cussing and referred to me as a female.
Oh, wow.
That's, so it's like, hey, what's, that's not cool. And, you know, but other than that, I've seen the instances of misogyny dropping. And I think the last time I saw something that was really overt was when I was in Denver a couple of years back, and, you know, had a creepy old stagehand guy standing over me and a very attractive carpenter while we were taping down cables. And I really like the way you ladies tape down cables. And I'm like, ew, come on, man. But it, like, you know, but as I've said, one of the things that's been really cool in the arc of my career is that, you know, I've met people that really respect what I do and how I think and the way that I get things done.
Yeah.
To get done quickly. I have a drill sergeant's voice, and I can project my voice across a football field if I need to. Yep. Some people don't enjoy it being next to me, but sometimes it's really great when I need to get something done. There's one producer that we've worked together with. I worked with him in Dallas last summer, and somebody was trying to get somebody else's attention in this loud, noisy ballroom. And he kept saying, you know, the guy's name, and his voice fell off about 10 feet out of his face.
Yeah.
And finally I breathed in, and this producer that we know, he took a step back and turned his head. I'm like, yo, whatever your name is, get over here. Your boss needs you. All the work in the ballroom stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris said, I knew you were going to do that. I was like, and this poor guy was like, you know, I had said this kid's name about 10 times and he wasn't getting over any of the noise in the room. It's funny.
Yeah, no, I learned that from you.
Yeah. It's all from the diaphragm.
Yes, ma'am. You hit also in as recently as 2017, I had a real blatant misogynist come on a show site with myself and crew in DC, and he mm-hmm. was at my age or older. So it was something to hear you say the younger ones.
Yeah. You know, some of the younger ones in the South, they have a mentality of how women are supposed to act because their dad's raised them that way, or it's from their church. Mm. And it's typically cultural. And sometimes it's, you know, we're used to the old guys and we're used to dealing with that. But when somebody refers to you as a female, that's a term that's rather dehumanizing.
Exactly.
You know, and that's new. That's a new wrinkle. But it seems like it's okay because they don't call you a broad or a chick.
Yeah, it's not okay though.
So yeah, but it's not.
When you're saying it's more recent, are you talking about like past 2016? Because I mentioned this guy on one of our Women in AV, and the panelists mm-hmm. were like, you know, with the Trump movement, mm-hmm. that maybe we've lost some ground with some people.
No, this was this spring. So I was working, I work for Major League Baseball in the summer. That's my summer gig.
Okay.
And we were out working on a broadcast dock, and we were connecting broadcast signal from the trucks to go up to New York.
Okay.
And things, you know, some of the panels and some of the processes had changed, but this young man had been there working with the folks from MLB for 2 days, and I had, you know, as a pre-rig, if you will, for the broadcast. And I was, you know, even though I'd seen the paperwork, I hadn't seen the new input output ports that we were connecting to the new IO.
Sure.
And he was trying to make me do things his way, and the truck broadcasters do things completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to bridge the gap between the two. And it was not going well. It did not go well at all.
Gotcha.
We eventually got things resolved and got the show off the ground.
I think all of us are.
It was very close.
Some of the men in our industry are taking a step back into their, you know, Neanderthal ways or the Neanderthal teachings.
It's difficult to tell. I haven't had any real major league run-ins with anybody since I ran into somebody who was being a little bit snotty at Cobo a couple of years back. Right after the election. But at the same time, over the last few years, especially after I cut my hair shorter, I don't get as much crap from guys because it's like, oh my God, you're a big scary lesbian. I do not want to piss you off. Enjoy doing that. I never like that. But sometimes after saying the same thing or giving the same instruction or asking people to do the same thing repeatedly over and over and over again, or asking them to stop what they're doing so that another group can, another piece of the puzzle can get put in place, or you just come at me barking at me because lunch isn't ready or the coffee's cold. Like, that's my fucking problem. I don't dig it. And I do everything I can absolutely positively all the time to try and walk that fine line and deal with my own emotional states. But at the same time, being a project manager, you're in that hourglass, you're the pinch point in the hourglass, where you're getting stuff from above constantly.
Yes.
And you're getting all the stuff from below, and everybody seems to think that you are the one person who is there to manage their problems, and you're the one punching bag. You're the one person who can take all the verbal abuse, and that it's perfectly justified in doing so. And after a while, you just go, okay, I can't, I can't tell you how many times I've gone out onto the back dock and cried after a show starts.
It's because there are these guys that you can't release that on. You can't necessarily just get rid of that person.
Yeah. And especially when you have a department head or somebody like that, who's just abusive, mildly abusive, not so much to the point where it's like overt, but it's low enough and slow enough that it just kind of passes for them being cranky.
Yeah.
And you have to put up with that crap for 3 months in the pre-planning process just to get into show. Mm-hmm. And then once you get to show, it ramps up to 10, but he only does it when you're around by yourself, just the two of you.
Yes. So you
that kind of stuff.
Proof. You almost like you tell somebody that this is happening and have them understand what you're talking about.
Right. There's no way to prove it.
Right.
But I've done things, where I've gone off into dressing rooms backstage, shut the door and grabbed a towel off the rack and screamed into it because there was no other thing to do. Hmm? There was no other way. And there was nobody else to talk to about it.
Yeah. Like the guy that I met in 2017, he was actually our client. And he was the most sexist person I have run into in my entire life. Overtly racist and sexist. Mm-hmm. It was a horrible experience, but he's our client.
Okay.
How do you run away?
You're freezing a little bit and crunching up.
Yes. Producers agree. Well, better it was me than you. They can overdub me.
Where'd you go?
Nowhere.
Your video went blank.
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Technology.
I think. Yeah. And, not to dwell on the dark stuff. I mean, the one thing that I've ever seen that just, there was like a rash in like a year of butt slapping going on in my life backstage and in shows, where in 1 year somebody slapped me on the ass twice, two different guys, in front of crew, where it was seen by our boss, and nothing happened to them. And I got in trouble for being pissed off about it. And then one time I did see an executive with his executive assistant backstage where she had made a really big mistake that the CEO said on stage. And it was a mistake in the verbiage. And she just blanched, and her boss, was talking to her about it, and, you know, just said, smacked her on the ass and said, "Oh, you'll get over it, kid." Like,
Oh my God.
Everybody backstage is blanched. What? All three women backstage is blanched. I'm like, I can't believe I just saw that. And I hope to God this woman brings a lawsuit so that we can burn this mother to the ground.
Wow.
Yeah. He left that company, and the lady that he assaulted is still with that company. I still see her on the shows that I do.
Oh, that's good.
She's never done anything about it.
Oh, she never did anything about it?
And no, she didn't. And just like even though I was assaulted backstage, I didn't do anything about it because, you know, I didn't want to get busted for overreacting. I was a freelancer. Mm-hmm. Sue the crap out of the company, the production company that was involved. So many of my friends worked for that company.
Yeah.
I thought about them before I thought about me, and I couldn't think of a way around this or how to do anything about it that would be meaningful or, you know, not ensure that I would never work for that company again. Or that I would get, you know, a black mark next to my name and never be hired again. As I was coming up in this industry, there was, you know, there weren't too many guys who were willing to mentor a female,
yeah,
mentor a woman, mm-hmm, in the business, right? And classes, even though, you know, and sometimes I asked to take classes and things like that to learn things, I was always denied. But it was also because of the management of the companies that I was working for at the time.
Right.
I learned stuff by hanging out and being, once I got to this, I had a conversation with Sean McCarthy. We were drinking at a Staging Solutions party one night, and he came to me and he said, "I really wish your management style would change because we need to listen. You need to be able to listen more. You don't have to know everything. And your insistence that you do makes it difficult for us to come to you and tell you that things are wrong or happening or whatever." And I took that to heart. Mm. I took that to heart. Cause I, you know, when I was really green, I had a bigger ego. I mean, a giant ego about, how I was supposed to be and how I was supposed to present to the crew and how I was supposed to know everything and solve all the problems for everyone. Right.
Right.
And I wasn't taking into account the things that they knew and the things that they could teach me.
Very true.
And once Sean brought that to light, and I went, "Oh, okay." And I started thinking about it more and more. And I started thinking more about, you know, what kind of captain do I want to be? Do I want to be, you know, Captain Kirk, or do I want to be Captain Picard? Because yeah. Picard was, you know, very authoritative, but he still took advice from all of his crew because he knew he didn't understand everything. He couldn't solve every problem. Whereas Kirk just barrels in there and shoots stuff and kicks a Gorn in the balls and says, "All right, we're done. Let's move on."
Exactly.
So I started spending time with, I would spend time talking to my video engineer and my data engineers and saying, "Okay, we needed to design a system. I need to put the bid together, and I don't want to screw you guys once we get on job site with having the wrong equipment. Let's talk about the scope of what's happening. You know, I'd like to spend 15 minutes with you on the phone, mm-hmm, tell you what we're expecting, how many screens we're doing, and then you tell me how to build the system, and do you mind if I send you a wiring diagram?" And they go, "Well, yeah, that'd be great." It's like, so I'd send it to them, fax it to them, or whatever, and then send it back. And I learned so much working on those systems just from doing that and then spending time with the lighting department, you know, I had some basic idea of lighting, but talking to lighting about how certain things get done. And then rigging, I learned from actually going out and being a stagehand at different points. When I, you know, after I quit working full time for a production company here in town, there was this gap where when I was first freelance that I needed to do stuff. So, and make money. So I was hiring myself out as a stagehand, and I joined the local and got on the crew list and all like that. And I think that taught me a lot because I was willing to, you know, they had seen me in management before. It's like, I said, okay, guys, look, I'm dressed in black today. I don't have the answers for you, but it's like, I'm in black. I'm dressed in black. I don't have your answers today. Apparently that's our boss over there. Let's go talk to him.
Yeah.
Or her. And I learned a lot from that experience too, how to be much more humble and how to, I don't know if you get this or not, but sometimes, you know, I have a face that if, or the way that I stand, that if I'm in the grocery store, people ask me where stuff is, even though I'm in, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, and I obviously don't work there. They ask me, where's this? It's like, or sometimes I go, oh yeah, it's down there.
You have this way of carrying yourself, yeah, where you look like you're the smartest person in the room.
Yeah. And it happens in airports and hotels that I'm staying in, that I'm a guest in, but not working in.
I've had
so
it.
So
I just can't say
that. Looking at that. Yeah. So understanding that, you know, that presence, it's like, okay, I'm going to not be your boss today, mm-hmm, but I'm here with you and I'm going to push cases. I'm going to work as hard as you, if not harder. Because if I just stand there and point and click, like I'm the boss, but I'm not, you're not going to respect me next time I am the boss.
True. True.
You know,
I'm sure there's a lot of people in DC, they're saying the same thing about me right now, because I've been that person working alongside of them. And then somebody will come up to me and go, hey, Ray, so I'm like, no, not my show. This is not my show. I'm one of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, one of the things that the philosophies I've always had as a project manager is, you know, never ask somebody to do something you're not willing to do yourself.
Yes.
And in my morning speeches or the safety talks or whatever that I have to give now, or even, you know, that I started doing about 5 years ago, I started explaining to them. It's like, look, guys, you're here, you're professionals, you're here for a reason. We hire you because, you know, this is your job. This is how you do you know, you're really good at what you do. This is why you're here. And I'm your production manager. I'm not going to ask you to do anything I wouldn't do myself, but I can't duplicate myself 35 times and do all the stuff. And what I'm going to ask you to do also is, you know, if at some point your job or what your department head is asking you to do is too much, let me know so that we can, you know, find a solution, because we can't do the show without you and you can't work for us. You know, nobody would want to work for us after a certain point if they found out that we were, you know, mistreating the crew. We want to make sure that you guys have a good experience with whoever the client is. We want to make sure you have a good experience and we have a good, you know, good working relationship going forward. And there have been times where I've hired people that, you know, or been hired by people. Let me back that up. I've been hired by people that do not follow that tenet at all. And so consequently, I fired those clients. I don't work for people who treat people like crap.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you get to a point.
You know, or put them in danger. Yeah.
Yeah. You get to a point where you can pick and choose. So maybe early on when we had to suffer through some of these people we didn't like, didn't want to work with, we had to keep going back from time to time and still take that paycheck, even though we didn't want to. But then you get that reputation and you have more clients and you have opportunities. And you can tell the ones you don't like, not doing it.
I sold my soul. I don't know how many times. I mean, I worked on Pat Robertson's 70th birthday party.
Okay.
I mean, that guy. Yeah, it was super fun going to the barbecue afterwards. I'd gone from my job at the hotel. There was the barbecue out at the ranch later. And I drove some Betacam decks, Digibeta decks from the hotel out to the ranch for the records, backup records. And I was hanging out at front of house afterwards with my producer, and Pat Boone got on stage and was screaming about, you know, if we don't, you know, get together and pray and take care of our country, they're going to allow queers to get married. Shrinking by my producer. Oh my God. I did PowerPoint for John Ashcroft. And
Oh, God. Yeah.
All kinds of,
there are times.
You know, I sold my soul a couple different times.
I did.
I just needed to. I needed a paycheck.
Yeah. You know, I more than once worked for someone in a religious aspect that I know was one of those scammers. You know that he doesn't believe what he's preaching on stage because you get to see him backstage. And
right.
As soon as I didn't need the paycheck anymore or that one last thing, I was like.
Yeah. I was this far away from Jerry Falwell.
Like inches.
Backstage in College Station. I worked on George Bush's 80th birthday party out in College Station because I was the only stagehand in town with any knowledge about skydiving. And I had just gotten my instructor rating from president of the USPA, the U.S. Parachute Association, Glenn Bangs. I just got my instructor rating in May and this gig was in June. But I was backstage with my friend Dave Taylor, who works for Sonova. They do the Oscars. They do the video. He's the video project manager on the Oscars. But we'd hired him to come help us with this. And he and I are standing backstage and we're this far away from John, from Jerry Falwell. And we're both like, that was a tough one. And I love this. I've never asked for an autograph backstage. I've only asked one time. And I asked George Herbert Walker Bush to sign my skydiving logbook next to my instructor stamp that Glenn Bangs had signed. Glenn was the guy who took the former president on his first two sport jumps.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I got trained by the guy that took a president to skydive twice.
Awesome.
So
that's really,
yeah, cool. And that's the only time I've ever asked for an autograph or, you know, asked a celebrity to do anything aside from, you know, be cool, stand here, shut up.
Right.
You know, the whole backstage thing.
So speaking of awesome events, I want you to tell us about the unveiling first Metro train in Houston.
Oh yeah. That was 2004-ish. So Houston had, I'm going to give you some history about the city really quick because I've been here for a long time and I love this city. Houston had trolleys, had first horse-drawn rail trolleys and then electric trolleys up until the 1930s-ish, 1940s, even though those rails were on dirt roads because most of downtown wasn't paved until the 60s. And so the rail drivers, they wanted to unionize and get better money and all that other stuff. And unions were becoming a thing in Texas. And the mayor, William Hobby, said, you know what? Screw those guys. I'm not paying them anymore. And I'm not paying for this stupid rail system anymore. And he fired all of them and he ripped up all the rail lines. And so for 60, 70 years, Houston didn't have a rail system. So the Metro rail trains, when they came in, it was a big deal. It was parked in the, one of two that was parked in the rail barn out by Fannin on the south side of town near Reliant. So we got this 135 135 foot long rail train, electric train with a 20,000 volt catenary system above it. We're working under strict OSHA regulations, steel toed boots, hard hats, the whole thing. And we had to figure out how to rig a truss system to the ceiling without touching the catenary and figure out a way to unveil the train with all the lights and the whistles and everything like that, and not, you know, not electrocute ourselves or anybody who was in the train.
Anybody else?
Because the train was going to be live with the lights and everything, right? So we had, you know, some wiggle lights and a truss, and we had a kabuki system, and we had 135 foot long kabuki system. And this in 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we filled up the curtain with all this fog. And as soon as, and we had a couple of really, really Johnny on the spot stagehands, 35 to 40 minutes to re-rig the curtain.
Yeah.
And we dropped it about a half a dozen times to make the producer feel good about it. And it dropped perfectly every single time. And during the show,
I think all kabuki stories are like this.
Yeah. During the show, the guy who punched the button, kind of his finger, he was so nervous, a little sweaty finger, he double punched it. And it didn't drop on the first, it started to go on the first punch. And just as he was punching it again, a stagehand ran up there, this old grizzled guy. Looked like a rat on a running across a Chinese buffet. Grabbing the curtain and starting, like, oh, dude. However, the rest of it on the second punch, before the guy even had a chance to get his hand on it, it dropped. And it was really cool, fun thing. And I just, that one little tiny imperfection was the one thing that they wrote about in the papers, but still doing 135 foot kabuki drop. That washing machine solenoids, because the solenoids and the kabuki solenoids now are much different, and they're much more reliable. You know, these things would hang up if you looked at them sideways. But getting that done was really gratifying. It's super fun. And I learned so much, especially the rule of kabuki. And it's always an odd one during show.
Really?
And ever since I followed that rule, it's worked. It's a great superstition.
I like that. I hope everybody's listening. That is super cool.
And then that was in like August or September, and then January, the tracks were ready and the system was ready. It was January of 2000, I think. Yeah, that might've been 2003 that we did the kabuki, and then 2004, was the unveiling and putting the first train on the tracks on New Year's Day. So they were trying to think of a way to hide the train from the bus barn on the tracks to the first station at Fan and South. And they couldn't think of a way to hide it or mask it without impeding the tracks. Mm-hmm. And so during the meeting, I was standing there and I was like, well, why don't we just run it through a football banner? And they go, what? It's like, you know, at the beginning of a high school football game here in Texas, they have this paper banner that the team runs through. Like, they go, yeah. It's like, well, why don't we just do that with the train? Just make a big printed football banner, and the train runs through it, you know, 20-ish miles an hour, and it's going to be it's as fast as a football player. And I spent a lot of time, spent about a month figuring out what material would be good, doing some R&D, figuring out how to, you know, there was a post on one side of the track that was really easy for us to attach the banner to, but there was nothing on the other side.
So for folks who don't know, explain to us what R&D means.
Research and development, right?
There you go.
Um, you know, screwing around with trying to think of the best way, you know, come up with the systems that are going to work.
Yeah. Brainstorming.
Metal objects or a post hole digger or anything like that. So, because I remember doing a video shoot at one of the refineries early on in my career where they were using water drills, you know, water systems to drill into the earth so that they could fix a pipe or whatever to excavator, a water excavator, and then they would suck out the water with a vacuum pump. Mm-hmm. It's like, so that was the solution to fixing that problem. So we wound up getting a water excavating company to come out and dig a hole for us. And then we put a post in and filled it back up. So it's, you know, there was one of those shows or one of those really ridiculously elaborate gags that took a lot of, you know, where I got to pull on so many different aspects of what I do and what I know. I even involved a parachute rigger to help me build the banner because we made it out of a particular fabric rather than paper. Because we built a banner of the right size and paper and, you know, 15 mile an hour wind, it's like, it shredded.
Yeah.
So we did have to come up with a textile option, which wasn't fun.
When you're researching that textile, I'm imagining how difficult that was because you not only had to have something that was going to react the way you wanted it to, had to be printable.
Mm-hmm. So we wound up using a type of really lightweight sailcloth. Mm-hmm. And then we strung it up and we figured that it was, unless it was already compromised in some way, that it wasn't going to tear properly. And we wanted it to tear in a certain way. So we cut a pattern in it, like a zigzag, in one of the test pieces. And we took it to this shop and I got my nearly new brand, fairly new Nissan Xterra. And I ran it backwards at 20 miles an hour through the banner to make sure it was going to break properly. And that was, that worked really well. Actually it worked. It worked on the first try. So we knew we were on the right track.
That's great.
Yeah. I haven't thought about that show in a really long time. You know, it's all this time and effort for this 30-second gag. You know, we do this over and over and over again in our industry. It's like work, 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 wait. There's the thing, poof, and then it's gone. It's one of the cool things about our industry is being able to, you know, utilize so many different skill sets and ideas and learnings and things like that to create something really fun and really neat. What's kind of a bummer about it is the intransigence of it. You know, it doesn't last very long. You know, it's there for a few seconds or a few days, and then it gets packed up and put in a truck and taken somewhere else. Or it never exists again.
Right. Or it's a one-off and it never happens again.
Right.
So I want to pick your brain a little more about being a project manager.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I've learned from you is thinking 5 steps ahead,
mm-hmm.
in your pre-planning. Tell our listeners about that.
There have been plenty of times when I was a tech and early on in my career where I got screwed because I spent many, many hours, more hours than I should have, working on something because somebody didn't tell me where these things were going, or they didn't plan ahead. They planned 2 steps ahead or 1 step ahead, or they didn't think through all the possibilities of how things could go to hell in a handbasket. Mm. And one of the things I think about as a project manager, and always have, to be honest, since I became one, or even as a producer, when I was with one production company, that was my title, even though I was just some kid, is I always think about 2 things, the butts in the seats, you know, who's going to see this and what they're going to get out of it and what it's going to take and the people who are going to make that happen and how much blood, sweat, and tears it's going to take to make this experience happen for this one person or this 1,000 people or these 10,000 people.
Right.
And balancing out that equation to me, where you get a lot of wow and awe versus as little effort as possible,
right?
Or to make it as meaningful as possible to these people who are creating it. That's a big deal, and so that's how I started that trajectory of trying to think five steps ahead. If we need to have, 10 trucks of stuff make it through one tiny door, how do we manage that process? Who really needs to be in there first? What equipment needs to be there first? And how do you pack and how do you communicate to the department heads how their trucks need to be packed?
Right.
So that stuff comes off in a proper order. It's not necessarily like tour management, but I borrowed some of that from talking to friends who have been on tour.
Yeah.
If I need to ask somebody to do something that is difficult and hard and requires a lot of effort, why don't I think about how it needs to be done so that they can do it right the first time? And if my communication isn't clear enough, or their way that they interpreted my communication wasn't clear enough, so that they only have to do it twice, instead of over and over and over again.
Yes.
You know,
a few of those in my life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and also thinking that five steps ahead, it saves labor. I mean, actual feet on the ground and perspiration and dedication of these people to get something done. But it saves the client money, because if you only have to do it once and you do it right once the first time, and you anticipate their, and provide them thought processes and questions about, things that they probably haven't thought of because they're not theater people, because they're not AV people. They might be, Jill from marketing, who's never done a show before.
Yes.
or Bob from marketing, who's never done a show before, which might be worse.
Right.
Cause I've been in the shows where somebody sells an idea, and empties out a warehouse somewhere and throws a bunch of guys into a room, with me and maybe one or two other women, and going, all right, here's the vision, go. And you're like, eh, what? Oh, and you have to get it done in 6 hours. You're like, oh my God. Okay. So that's a little hyperbolic, but at the same time, that's, that never made sense to me. It never made sense to me. And thinking, and because somebody didn't think ahead, one time I didn't, I spent 3 days limping a production truck to California when it should have taken me a day and a half to get there from Dallas. But it took us 3 days because they didn't think to have the truck that had been sitting for 6 months, an unleaded gasoline truck in a winter environment, checked out, have the brakes checked, have the gas tank cleaned, have the truck tuned up before you drive it 2,000 miles one way. Mm. It never occurred to him. And we spent thousands of dollars in a couple days of our time limping that thing to California, stopping above a really long, tall hill because the brakes had failed. And that truck wound up getting towed into our job site.
Oh, my God.
And then the crew, the truck drivers on that crew, were expected to all drive back together in two truck cabs as opposed to three truck cabs. So six of us in four bobtail, or in two bobtails.
Ouch.
Yeah, for 2 days. And then that same show, the producer didn't ask enough questions during the site visit, and the set wound up being 2 feet tall, too tall for the ballroom. And it was built out of 3/4-inch plywood with practical working doors in the bottom.
Oh, lovely. So you can't even cut 2 feet off the bottom.
Right. So they And they emptied out the office to do the and hired like five professional stagehands. So we had a crew of about 20 people to put together like these multiple scenic flats and all the projection and all the sound and all the lighting to go with it, and like 20 people. And we were already, you know, the crew was already beat to hell from the drive over. And then we find out that the set's too big. And we almost killed three people trying to put up the flat the first time, and it was too tall. And we had to bring it back down without any benefit of a hoist or a winch or anything. And I mean, this set piece weighed close to 1,000 pounds.
Wow.
And I always, you know, that show was, and then the show afterwards, same client. And we got fired from the second show, period, forever. The lack of information, the lack of thought, the lack of planning, the lack of, you know, just being absolutely focused on budget. It really took a toll on the people who had to make that show happen. You know, we had people falling asleep at their positions and missing cues.
Yeah.
That always affected it, the way that I've thought about, you know, how to do my job. And also the other thing too is, if I have to work a crew, somebody from, you know, I don't plan enough crew people. I don't plan properly for the right amount of labor. And I got people at work till 2 o'clock in the morning and they've been there since six.
Yeah.
And then I put them in a car to drive home.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not cool. And who's to say that that stagehand didn't make a bad decision and, you know, do an overnight load in before he came to my gig?
Yeah. I was going to say, and there's more to that sometimes.
Yeah. Say he's diabetic and hasn't, or he's got some medical issues that, you know, could be affected by a lack of sleep or exhaustion.
Right.
You know, those are the things I always try to think about, the people who make the show happen, not necessarily the department heads. I mean, I think about them too, but I really, really think about the men and women who wear black, who come and make these things happen for us. All these people who are the planning, the creative types and everything like that. They're the ones who actually make the show work. They're the one who make it happen.
Right.
So
staying five steps ahead. I just stumbled all over myself with this echo. So staying five steps ahead is really a good thing all the way around. It helps you to enact all these things that you've learned to avoid over the years and create more successes.
The other thing too, about thinking five steps ahead, you know, when your client asks you for something or you do something, you know, whatever, being five steps ahead and anticipating some of that weirdness that comes at a show.
Yeah.
You know, and you pull something out of a trunk that you know that client might want, but hasn't asked for, but you think they might. It's like, have you got, hold on a second. Here, I have this for you. You look like a rock star. An absolute rock star.
Absolutely. I've done that.
Yeah.
Also makes you feel good because you were looking at their bigger picture and seeing some of the small things that they were missing. They may have reviewed a list. They may have talked about things. They may have said, I don't need that. Mm-hmm. And minds were looking at it going, yeah, I think you're going to want that.
Oh yeah. I mean,
I'm going to put it in my back pocket.
It used to drive one of my bosses crazy that I would put CYA gear in my breakouts budget. And it used to make one of my clients a little bit crazy that I did that. But every single time I had those pieces of equipment that I knew that they were going to ask for, that they kept telling me to cut out of the budget, I put them in there anyways. And damn if we didn't use them every single time.
Yeah. I've had many of those as well. Well, I'm going to wrap this up so I can let the crew go.
All right.
But you and I should talk soon for sure.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye, lady.
Bye. Thanks for listening, everybody. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Check out our website at feedthecrewpodcast.com for more information, as well as links to all of our episodes, bulletins, and social media.
When you're hungry for
inspiration,
information,
friends, and laughter,
join us
on Feed the Crew.